Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Effects. I can never fault the introductory music. Never. Scratchy, wobbly, it was being recorded on man, who knows what. But for me, it's a very profound message. And in case you're wondering why Louis Armstrong, to me, he represents a darkness, a stain, while he was performing like this, and then went on to be an icon of the jazz world, international. He experienced a tremendous bitterness toward him because of his race. I mentioned this today, that this is a man who prevailed. What do we see of him? What to remember? It's like we see this gregariousness, this performer willing to please, putting himself out there to satisfy the audience that wouldn't eat in the same restaurant with him or expect him to stay in the same hotel as them. It's an odd chemistry, an odd symbiosis sometimes that makes the world go round. But Louis Armstrong prevailed. And above all, there's a rightness or a correctness to that what he was able to do. That talent, whether you're a diehard fan of jazz or not, I think there's a compelling message in this type of person. Something that is a value that we can cling to. If I'm not mistaken, he was a member of the craft. But apart from that, I think the craft has a gravity that pulls. It doesn't create, but it pulls essential values from the world. The performance and acts of men. It pulls them together into some type of coherent narrative, thanks to the observations. Otherwise, this type of man would come and go and nearly hardly be mentioned, except all through history. These acts of nobility have been marked to inspire and encourage and define. So the artistry of masonry continues on, and so does the West End Blues 1924. Welcome today. This is the 15th. Yeah, showing off my technical ability. I'm just trying to close it down for next week. 15th day of the year. We're coming up to Robbie Burns Day before I see you again, don't I? Don't we? Don't we? Don't I? It's on the 25th of January. I won't be around then to say to have a toast with you. It's only I think there's a countdown toward Robert Burns Day. It's remarkable. It's just shortly after my wife's birthday, and a lot of birthdays in my life going on. Robert Burns is exceptional in that we think of him as the spokesman, the voice of the disenfranchised at the time. Nobody really spoke in that impolite manner with that frank, direct type of language. There was effort to subterfuge. So the Burns dinner, it's a celebration. It's a celebration of life and the poetry of Robert Burns. And the suppers are normally held on or very near his birthday on the 25th. And they're known as Robbie Burns Day, Burns Night, you know. The first supper was held in memorandum at Burns College by Robert Burns' friends on the 21st of July, 1801, the fifth anniversary of his death. And it's been a regular occurrence ever since. The first still extant Burns Club was founded in Greenock in 1801 by merchants born in Ayrshire, some of whom had known Burns. They held the first Burns supper on what they thought was his birthday, the 29th of January, 1802. But in 1803, they discovered in Ayr Parish records that his real birthday was the 25th of January. And since then, the suppers have been held on or around the 25th. They can be formal or informal, and they typically include a haggis. And it gives reason for lots of boyish, childish giggles. Haggis, it's just the food, and the Scotch whiskey, and the recitation of poetry. It's remarkable. Formal dinners are known to be hosted by such Burns clubs, the Freemasons or St. Andrew's societies, and occasionally end with dancing when ladies are present. A piper generally greets the guests, and they gather and mingle. And it's a spirited type of an event, isn't it? From the haggis slipping off the board, landing on the floor in a splat, to the toast to the haggis, to the ode to the haggis, you know. The address to the haggis, fair fire, you're honest, sonsy face, I think. Sonsy, jolly face, sonsy. Great chieftain of the puddin' race, aboon them ye take your place, plek, triple hunter, heart, triper, harm. I can't. Never, I don't think it's right without a proper accent, and yet, just feels good to say it in whatever accent. So keep an eye out for the event, and open up your copy of Robbie Burns. We'll read today one of my favorite Burns poems, just because. And today we have an incredible commentary. And I think you're going to be well pleased with the program. Thank you for the response from so many of you for the past dialogues and the commentaries and your encouragement. This is a noteworthy week. Yeah, John Donne was born on this day, the writer and thinker. Yeah, and we're coming up to Tatiana Day. That's a day in Russia that's celebrated when the students and faculty all mingle and drink and carouse and carry on. Then, before I see you again, we'll be celebrating on the 26th Stefan Grappelli's birthday. He's born in 1908. Remarkable jazz. We've heard him on the program. We've played the Grappelli and then the very next day, it's a nice way to remember. We have Robbie Burns Day on the 25th, his birthday. Stefan Grappelli's birthday on the 26th, and then Mozart's birthday, amazing, yeah, on the 27th. Just a nice little mnemonic, I hope, for you to carry with you. Put that in your shirt pocket today. It's we're going to start the show with a bit of start the program with a bit of a pace. I think this will tell you where I am and what I'm doing right now. This is from Johnny Mercer and Margaret Whiting. Some of you probably were around when it was originally produced. Hope you like it. 1949. Oh, year of my birth.
I really can't
but
stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go
but
away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so
in.
Very nice.
I'll hold your hands. They're just like
my mother will start to
beautiful, what's your
and
hurry?
And father will be pacing
listen to the fireplace.
So
roar.
Really, I'd better
beautiful, please don't
and
hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink.
Put some records on while I
the neighbors might say. What's in the spring? I wish I knew
your
how
eyes are like starlight
to
now.
Break the spell.
I'll take your hand. Your hair looks
I
warm.
Ought to say no, no,
mind
no.
If I move in
at least I'm going to say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurt my pride?
I really can't
baby, don't hold out. Baby,
oh, but it's cold.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The answer
but
is no.
Baby, it's cold outside.
It's welcome
how
and sweet.
How lucky that you dropped
so
in.
So nice and warm.
Look out the window at that
my
door.
My sister will be suspicious.
Gosh, your lips look delicious.
My brother will be there at the
waves
door.
Waves upon the tropical shore.
My maiden aunt's mind is
ooh,
suspicious.
Your lips are
maybe just a cigarette.
Never such a blizzard before.
I've got to get home.
But baby, you freeze out there.
Say, let me a call.
Get up to your knees out there.
You've really been
I thrill when you touch my
but
hand.
But don't you see?
How can you do this thing to me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong
at
sorrow.
At least there will be plenty.
If you caught pneumonia and
I really
died,
can't
get over that old doubt.
The charm, 1949. War was over in one place and cooking and percolating in Korea. It's always been a bit of background tension and adjustment going on. No surprise there. No surprise. We want to sink into the commentary today. Have we awakened the dreamer in you? Have we made a convincing and compelling argument that we are in need of the dream? If people are good only because they fear punishment and hope for reward, then we are a sorry lot indeed. Can you tell me who said that? Does it matter? It will matter. Sad that it has to matter, the status of the person. Today we find all kinds of celebrity hawking their goods and their ideas and their positions and their doctrines as if celebrity gives any kind of credibility. I've never known celebrity in itself to create new chemistry or new mathematics or new music. No genius does that. Education is not the learning of facts, but the training of the mind to think. Who is this strange man? Who said, anyone who has never made a mistake has never tried anything new. Let's embrace this if we can. Not to, you do that, you know, and I don't mean to enter into a tautology here. This is a progressive state of being for masonry. Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. Think the opportunity. Once we accept our limits, we go beyond them. What are the limits of us as Masons? What are they? We're not lazy. We're not impertinent. We're not thoughtless. We are what we are. And that's not beyond description. It just takes a bit of effort to come up with something sensitive and sensible. Surely we cannot be so glib our entire lives to think that we can be summed up with something on a bumper sticker, the frame of a license plate. Hardly does service to an order this old. People are only good because they fear punishment. Dear me, dear me, dear me. Peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved by understanding. These are wickedly difficult to execute. Wickedly difficult to execute. Because we're so impaired in our thinking. We don't accept that. We can see that we can overwhelm somebody with military power. Therefore, that creates peace. But it doesn't. Peace is a protagonist and an antagonist. So how do we understand? You are the body, the embodiment of that type of notion at the expense of other things. We pay a price. But ultimately and safely, we're the body of insight. Allegedly, and always allegedly, anyone would be a bit foolish to walk around thinking that you're going to, the insight is just going to pour over you because you take our obligations, you finish your rituals, or you're a good ritualist or a good historian. For the most part, we're talking about the clamor to understand something that's very, very different and unique in the face of the earth. So our history is often very narrow. You'll hear Masonic history so often. Any idea what that means? Is that history about Masons, or is it history as written through the eyes of Masonry? And is it by one person or a collective version? So then it's reasonable that history is a human, something that human beings constructed. We built it, like we constructed time, the measurement. We constructed that. You imagine the challenge faced if we were functioning in communities with trade and commerce, with justice, a system of justice, a system of social order, but we didn't have any alphabet, or we didn't have numbers. And yet we would experience life and death. Was it the same then as it is today? Well, we struggled for answers and came up with the best answers to fit that fit the information that we had at hand. And there was a considerable amount of superstition because we didn't have the high performance measurement and tools that we do today. Oh, we were so much more clever. Well, we also have a larger burden. And now, perhaps even then, we're defining how we seem to be consuming our own tail. Some of you will understand that what that refers to. We're beginning. We have this, and it's not we as a collective. Some people have known this philosophically for a long, long time. But the masses are beginning to awaken to the notion of our need to survive and our ability to see ourselves as a global community. It's not just an idea anymore. It's not just a dream. It's a functional reality because we can see the hard science. We can see the globe. We see where we all live. And it's not a stretch of the imagination to see that thin, thin veneer of blue against a background of the vacuum of space and realize how fragile, how literally thin is the very thing in which our entire existence depends. So we have some complications. And I don't think Masonry I think we have a wonderful relationship with one another. And we preserve that, and we know that. But I don't want to... I can do that. I've done that a lot. Had wonderful relationships and good times. And as I enter the move out of the autumn of my life into the winter of my life, I want something a little more understandable. I have this appetite for meaning. I need to understand. And I don't want to define my fellow man as the enemy or stupid or... I don't want to do that. That creates a sense of elitism that I don't like. I don't think it's realistic. We're all in this together. We're all trying to do the best we can in our own particular way, and it's difficult. It's a challenge because sometimes we can be seen to be working at in opposite directions. Remember the rooting, the geometry that Freemasonry brings to the discussion. Don't think about it as if one of the parrot heads is saying it. And I do that. I use that term fondly, parroting parrot Masons. It was to me that phrasing came from the works of the 1930s, where there was a statement about people parroting, saying the words without having any understanding of what they meant, no understanding. It's like, oh my goodness, yeah, you know, that does happen. So we're not talking about parroting, we're talking about people making a genuine effort to answer your sincere question. This is part of the reason. The commentary today is entitled The Angst. We wear watches, but we don't have time. Many of us were raised to accept a paradigm of superiority. Mankind, not part of nature, but created to dominate, above and detached. Mastery of nature, technology, out of control. The results of all these things are now being visited on us, I would say. Scientists revealed in the 80s that we are in the midst of a mass extinction. who cared. Business went on as usual, delusionally aiming toward a future of continued economic growth, with this loose idea that as the oligarchs became richer, all of that great wealth would somehow trickle down and save the most impoverished and improve the quality of their life. That's how we justified our tolerance of the utter inhumanity of poverty. We're able to do it. And some will even brag about it. The disgrace. Today, there are more depressed people. Development has created mass loneliness. Though our existence is a product of our part in the universe, an evolutionary process 200,000 years along on this slim planet, we seem to have lost the understanding. I don't know anymore that the ethos of masonry was intended to be achievable. Over 500 years, we have been housekeepers of the relics left by builders. Our greatest struggle is knowing we do not have a narrative that helps us address this reality. It's a great struggle. We are coterminous. A we-they dichotomy never existed except in our minds. We are one. Politics, human construction. If we are a cohort striving to achieve greater awareness, and if it is difficult for us as a group to create the new narrative that addresses the existential threat, then is this not an indictment of the entire human race? Where did that come from? Nothing out of control about a statement like that, is there? Business as usual is driving us toward extinction. We like that, don't we? We like patterns and predictability. We don't like to upset the order. Everything in its place, everything has its role. So know your role, know your place. Our sense of permanence, essential to our sense of self, is unraveling. As a Mason, concern for the common good, the urging and support to think about other people before I think about myself, to be forgiving, to be charitable, to assist where it's needed. As a Mason, I worry for mankind because my brethren, the enlightened, are accepting darkness. Do Masonic values die if there is no one around to contemplate them? Our permanence is an illusion. Should I learn the happy songs and passively accept the destruction of Mother Earth? Does it matter at all that we dream? That's not angst. What is? Put it in a bit of perspective. This is from 2001, Space Odyssey. Some of you remember when that was quite futuristic. Are we dreamers? Are we travelers? We travel through the things we don't know. Let's accept the fact that Einstein may have been onto something when he talked to us about needing to accept our limits, to understand them, that we have limits. And now did we ever stop? Did a man ever stop wondering about his place in the universe? I don't think that started with technology. I don't think that started with language. I think that is something that's essential. It's one of the essential elements. That's consciousness. And whether we're alone in the universe with this state of consciousness, we strive to hope that there are others. But consciousness isn't necessarily superiority. Being aware of what's going on around us is not dominance. It's understanding. So we collect information, but it's hard to understand what it is we're collecting. That takes the genius amongst us. And those are theorists that are putting together the facts, just the way the ancients did, to explain phenomena that's around us today the best way we can. Now, if you're a determinist, that means you'll probably be fixated. This will give you reason not to do anything. This will give you a reason to support your excuse of existence. You're doing nothing. You're thinking nothing. Your mind is in the past. It's all right. You can think and dwell in the past as much as you prefer, except our measurement of time moves on. So do you in many ways, but not necessarily your conscious state. If you're ready to embrace everything that was past as if it was better, then I'm not going to shatter that illusion. Everything better in the past, huh? Really? Strange that. Speaking about the past. I have a fascination with ritual, a curiosity about it. And it's just to understand the context of what the heck we're doing. We preserve, in a way, by our performances, something that was already a curiosity in Elizabeth I's time. You know, the 16th century, yeah. It was already a relic. And it was, these are like the production of plays and mystery plays was tedious. It was difficult. Because once you found the place, once you have the place, then you need to, a theater. And in London, the first one was called the theater. And then the next one, just a few hundred yards closer to the city, was called the curtain. And once you had that, then you had to have playwrights. Then you had to have actors. Well, this was going on. This period was going on during the Reformation and Counter-Reformation and then back and forth. And, there's the back and forth of it was about the rightness, the contests for the moral definition of the people. This is when we had the Puritans. The Puritan movement came forward and found great disfavor with some of the behavior of the gentry, of the kings. So by the time that Elizabeth was crowned, the mystery, those mystery plays that were moving around to different theaters and performances, biblical, were there was a series of biblical scenes enacted by Gilsman. And they went to smaller places. And then the smaller towns had more modest kind of acting, and just like our lodges, some of the bigger lodges, more successful, I'll say successful, more knowledgeable lodges. Their ritual has amazing depth, and for the smaller areas, it's much more modest. Yeah, but there was at the beginning, though, that those were already, the religious drama was already sort of, we already understand it, but it's not necessarily pertinent. That's from yesterday. Along come a bunch of people that didn't apparently have a vested interest in either point of view, said, right, you know, the principle of those plays is, it's not the process of the play. It's the principle. Look what they're trying to do. They're trying to portray the important values of life and being as reinforcers. Now, at the time, was there this sense of punishment if you didn't comply? Afraid so. You lose favor. You know, you're not going to be. Don't be too original in your thinking, because if you don't agree with the status quo, you'll lose favor. The free thinker and the Mason is about to commit himself to his own ideas, but also has the task of being a gentleman, causing offense or being inconsiderate to the people around. It was the Reformation. You know, we've talked about that so many times. So many good things came out of the Reformation. But it almost killed the religious drama. And yet the Renaissance had produced no comparable secular drama to take its place. All right, if we don't have religious drama, let's replace it with something else that portrays convictions without a religious undertone or overtone. But the Renaissance didn't. Actors were considered vagrants and rogues, and many of them were. They were just not, you know, upstanding members of the community. And I still remember that some actors at the period, actors would be corralled and pushed out of town, and the gates closed on them, so good people would be safe from their nefarious activities and influences. So we had now, first, those of you who are active students, here's a play that I want you to go and look for. This is the first regular comedy in English. Regular. It's called Ralph Royster Doister. R-O-I-S-T-E-R-D-O-I-S-T-E-R. Go and check that out. You'll find that had to do with Nicholas Udall, the headmaster of Eton. 16th century. Go and look for that. And there was another one called Gorboduc, the first regular tragedy. And Gorboduc was the first play to be written in blank verse. So there you go. A little bit to chew on. But the fact that we're performing these rituals today, or these religious dramas, are they still religious dramas? We play with some really explosive history. And we shape it. It's almost like we're playing with ideas of cowboys and Indians. The good of us are cowboys, and the bad of us are Indians. And we all have to accept our role. Except today, we consider that those simple boyish games have racist overtones. Who knew? When we discovered that, then good parents don't want their children to have that legacy placed on their shoulders. And that doesn't make it more difficult for the children. It makes it wearisome for some adults to think, I wasn't doing anything wrong at the time. Well, that's true. You weren't doing anything wrong at the time. But there were implications. And time has gone on. So we'll talk more about this as we move through. But I want to know, has your sense of masonry inspired you to see the think of the future, to think of a world where the common good is on everybody's mind, and it's expected, and the politicians and forms of government are held to that level of accountability, not to the persuasions of great orators, but an examination of outcomes. Is it all right that a few people live in great mansions on the top of the mountains while so many live in the poor quality land, barely able to survive? Okay, are we able to tolerate the knowledge that people are amassing great amounts of wealth at the expense of something? Somebody somewhere has to be exploited in order to do that. Well, here we go. Is this utopian? Is this achievable? Has this been awakened? The idea of the charitable acts, and oh my goodness, there's some remarkable efforts. Whether it's happening around where service clubs are, like happens here in Canada, or in areas where it was in place before service clubs were developed. So many acts of generosity that are needed, not conceptually, but in practical terms. And our brethren around the world are exhibiting that belief, that generosity. And it makes us all feel inspired that we can do this. Oh, far, far from being foresighted. No. But not everything about masonry is foresighted. We need some housekeeping too. When I talk about the being housekeepers, I'm thinking about big picture. It's no coincidence that Thomas More set Utopia on an island. He was a teenager when the Americas were discovered. The time when the world learned that more was possible than we ever knew. He could not have known that this discovery would change everything. With 1492 sparking a series of events that would propel humanity to become a very different species, one which today could no longer survive as most people survived then. More, Thomas More, was imaginative. But no human is capable of imagining change on the scale that it occurred. The search for utopias is the constant attempt to stretch our imaginations over what is possible. And as what is possible and achieved, all of the gains move around us, then our imaginations continue to stretch. 4 centuries after Thomas More, Oscar Wilde, a brother, wrote that the only worthwhile maps of the world were those which included utopia. Utopia was no longer a sensible subject of derision. So much was changing so quickly that clearly the near future would be very different from the recent past. So what mattered was how the future could be shaped and how we, with our limited imaginations, could try to look into the fog of possibilities. The worldwide emancipation of women that was well underway then was clearly one of the greatest changes to the species. Men had almost always dominated before and did in almost all other mammal species, but the change is only clear in hindsight. And few men saw it coming. We are changing as a species. For all eternity, humans have watched their children often die before them. Such suffering was thought unavoidable up to a century ago, when over a tenth of the children of the richest people of the earth, the English servant-keeping classes, died in childhood, a tenth of the wealthy. Today, child mortality rates in China are falling so fast that within a year or two, they could be as low as in the United States. Already, less than 1% of babies born in China die before their first birthday. On the island of Iceland, only 2 in every 1,000 infants die, and the rate is still falling. Worthwhile rates are falling fastest, such that we know that they cannot fall any faster than they are now, because they can never fall below zero. Never have we known such progress. But only a very few people saw this as possible just a few decades ago. The utopians have consistently been proved right in the long run. Our species is transforming into something new. We now understand that it is not the gods that suddenly decided that almost all children should live to see adulthood. Our agonizing about dystopia is the main way we achieve progress. We whine, we complain. We rightly complain about all the greed and selfishness and stupidity in the world. Occasionally, we need to recognize what this complaining achieves. And then we move on to look out for the next island of possibility. What world into which almost all our children will now survive is possible, especially now that we have so few children, because we can be so sure that they will live? The ideas of Professor Danny Darling, professor of geography at Oxford University. Remarkable. So do you accept? Ah, it's interesting, huh? Here I am, I have the temerity to ask you if you accept that we're changing as a species. Well, put the questions to yourself. Are we different than we were 100 years ago? Is our relation to one another different? Has the role of women functionally and essentially changed? It's like asking a fool about climate change. They'll look out the window and say, ah, no, it's a sunny day, or no, it's raining. We're talking about climate, not the weather. Talking about a species, not you and your life, me and my life. Are we as Masons continuously limited by our own life experience? Is that a fact? And should then the decisions and positions that you calculate from your own life position be sufficient to render judgment on other people around you? How do you reconcile that with the notion that you're going to support and protect, and you've taken an obligation that embraces another Master Mason? No names attached. Just another man striving, challenged with the responsibilities of his oaths and obligations to himself and humanity. That's all. You can see why these kind of conversations would be tedious if we got together in lodges and sat around and had it out like this all the time. It would be very tedious. We'd probably go running for the pubs. Oh, my goodness. This is a meal best served in small plates, with an appropriate and supportive atmosphere, with the right pairings of wine and dessert and cheese and music and conversation. That's what you bring to the Masonic experience for me. I've had those opportunities repeatedly. and love them. And that's not something I make happen. It's that experience of discovery when you are who you are. When you stop being self-conscious as a Mason, stop trying to please the gods. And then you begin to make sense and begin to describe what's happening around us each and every day as Masons. If we're really that good at and put that much energy and focus into the governance of our order, then one would think that we would be incredibly satisfied, that we can sleep well at night knowing that it is well organized and properly managed, always properly managed. And yet, Masonry inspires the dreamer. It inspires, I put to you, the utopian thought, the expectation that the imagination is always going to be greater than our actual accomplishments. And as the accomplishments continue, the imagination continues to stretch. The challenge. That's not for the good of the order or the bad of the order. That's the universal. It's the concepts that we teach are not Masonic. They're universals. Or are they not? You're laying claim that these are this is an elitist organization? I don't know. You'd be right. Absolutely right. So I'm going to read to you a couple of examples of poetry, and you decide which is the defining piece. One that was written in April 1786 by Robbie Burns, one of my favorites. I'll just read a little bit of a taste, and I'll try not to butcher accent and things like that. We modest crimson-tipped flower, now is me met in an evil hour, for I'm a crush amongst the star, the dust, thy slender stem, I step on you, to spare thee now is past my power, thou bonny gem. Alas, it's no thy neighbor sweet, the bonny lark companion meet, bending thee mang the dewy wheat. Twit, with speckled breast, with upward springing blithe to greet the purpling east. Sun's coming up. Could blow the bitter biting north upon thy early humble birth, yet cheerfully they glinted forth amongst the storm. Scarce rear above the parent earth thy tender form. Damn those poets, huh? Damn them. Why don't they make sense? Just once in a while. And then, I'm also a fan, I'll admit, of cowboy poetry. This is material written by Wendy Vaughn. Some of you may know of Wendy's work. She's a Calgary gal. This is called The Corral Bars Are Down. So I'm going to give you just a little bit about the original cowboy, what she writes about the original cowboy. Now, compare it to what we've just heard from Burns. Now, this speaks more to me because of my country roots. I like to still think of myself as country, although, you know, at my age, that's a bit of a stretch. But it's like the connection with my Scottish heritage. I'm very proud of that. But, you know, a couple of hundred years can't seem to knock that pride out of me. Original Cowboy by Wendy Vaughn. Once upon a horse, there was a man who, from on his lofty perch, did scan the vast and empty prairie waste as he sought to rid the permanent taste of stale tobacco from his dirty mouth. Oh, that cowboy was uncouth, but then his eyes were clear, his thoughts not as a muddled chain of emptiness as he approached an unsuspecting steer. One might wonder at the reason for it all and answer that everyone has a special call. There you go. One 100 years ago, I gazed upon this valley where the buffalo grazed and the clear, swift rivers of the waters of the Bow River raced. My eyes scanned the miles of mountains and hills. My ears heard the melody of the meadowlark's trills. My nose was enchanted with the sweet prairie smells. I saw no one as I gazed all around, only the wild prairie land and the free wild sounds, and an Indian grave, a stone-marked mound. I came to view often as the years rolled by from this great rolling hill on the valley's east side and watched as settlers came to make homes and take pride. And then their names took their place and everyone knew of Cochrane and Horse Creek and Dog Pound for a few and Jumping Pound and Grand Valley and Morley too. Then steadily but swiftly the valley's face changed, for cattle migrated unto the buffalo's range and the ruts of the travois for steel rails were exchanged. Next I saw homes scattered here. Nestled there at the foot of my big hill a town did appear, with a road leading down like a thin winding stair. The changes came swiftly as the season sped past. Coal was discovered, but the mines didn't last, and the wealth of the valley was found in her gas. And I've been away so long now that from the view of my throne, but today I've come back to gaze all around, and at the fingers of progress I can only astound. I looked across the valley to the great Rockies spread and quickly awed at the old Devil's Head, and then my eyes slipped slowly down the Bow River's thread. And as I stood there and gazed at this land I loved so, I saw the crocus still blooming and heard the larks trilling low. And I noticed beside me that others stood too. They felt the breezes as the west wind blew. Their eyes too were dimmed like a misty light dew. For this valley was now home to all of them too. Who does it right, eh? Who does it right? You do. You're part of that stream of effort and dream and understanding. Always a pleasure to have you here, to join you and have this conversation. I'm going to leave you with, I think, one of the most uplifting little ditties that could ever be. This is from the irreverent Monty Python's group. Called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. It's a wish that I hope you take with you through the week. I'll see you soon. But I won't see you for 2 weeks. I'm going to be traveling a wee bit. See you soon.
You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's bristle, grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you forgot. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow.
Forget about your scene. Give the audience a grin.
Enjoy it. It's your last day.
So always look on the bright side of death. And just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you.
And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
I'm a bright girl.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Was available
always
in the
look on the
right.
Always look on the right.
I said to him, Bernie, I said, I'll never make that money.